Eleanor Marx, A Life, is the new biography by Rachel Holmes. It tells the compelling story of Karl Marx's remarkable daughter, who achieved great things. She was a political activist, a pioneering feminist, and also the first person to translate Madame Bovary into English. Tracy Ann Oberman is the reader.
Eleanor Marx tumbles prematurely into the world in London on the 16th of January, 1855. Puffing anxiously on a cigar in a corner of the overcrowded room at 28 Dean Street, Soho, is Europe's greatest political scientist. Karl and Jenny Marx have another child. Exhausted, Jenny sips laudanum, held to her lips by Helen Daymut. Lenchen, as she's known to all the family, has been present at the births of all the Marx's children. Teeny as she is, the Marx's newborn baby daughter declares her arrival with hearty, indignant yelling. From the tiny back room, Marx hears six-year-old Edgar's monotonous cough. His sole surviving son is battling tuberculosis. Bright-eyed and feverish, Marx's once ebullient male heir clings to a thin precipice of life as his baby sister seizes onto it with clamorous vigour. The following evening, Marx writes a reflective note to his best friend, Friedrich Engels. Yesterday my wife was delivered of a bona fide traveller, unfortunately of the sex par excellence. Had it been a male, the matter would have been more acceptable. Father already to two daughters, Jenny Chen, 11, and Laura, 10, Marx is conflicted over the bearing of girls. He can hardly delude himself that his daughters might transcend entirely their 19th century circumstances of being a universal underclass. Yet since he was a youngster, Marx has recognised and loved women as equals. In the Communist Manifesto of 1848, Marx and Engels emphasised the need to do away with the status of women as mere instruments of production. He still hopes that education might strengthen a woman's possibilities. But, like every Victorian patriarch, he wants a son. 12 weeks after Eleanor's birth, Edgar dies in Marx's arms. Disconsolate, he turns to his newborn daughter, and to her he transfers all his love and hopes for his lost son. By the time she was 9 months old, Eleanor Marx was known by all as Tussie. The numerous likely sources for Tussie's nickname tells us something about the multilingual nature of the Marx's menage. Perhaps baby Tussie sneezed a lot as her lungs acclimatised to her father's cigar smoke. Tousser is the verb for cough in French. Tussie's sister spoke French with each other, French and German with their mother, and mainly German with their father, Lenchen and Engels. From the womb, Tussie swam in a fluid polyphony of German, French and English, with Dutch phrases and Yiddish tags from her paternal side thrown into the rich mix. Infant Tussie was looked after chiefly by Lenchen. Helen Daymut had known Jenny Marx since entering service in her parents' Rhineland home when she was just 15. The Marx daughters all describe Lenchen as their second mother. Grief at Edgar's death was intensified by privation. There was, as ever, a domestic cash crisis. Jenny visited the pawnbrokers, whilst her husband busied himself with the inaugural meetings of the International Working Men's Association. Recollected by the rest of her family as the most miserable time of their lives, Tussie never really remembered the pinched Soho years. In 1850, a German newspaper editor, calling himself Schmidt, arrived in London, purportedly to visit the Great Exhibition. In fact, Schmidt was Agent Wilhelm Stieber, briefed by the Prussian Minister of the Interior to spy on Marx. Stieber observed, "Marx lives in one of diverse quarters in London. There is not one piece of good, solid furniture in the entire flat. Everything is broken and tattered, finger-thick dust everywhere, and the greatest disorder. Your sight is dimmed by coal and tobacco smoke so that you grope around at first as if you were in a cave. It is dangerous to sit down. But nothing of this embarrasses Marx or his wife in the least. Mama, as Jenny Marx is called by her family, received two legacies following the death of two relatives. Marx urged Jenny to think about finding a new home. Mama found a small house in Kentish Town. Grafton Terrace was a short row of new-build homes in the middle of an incomplete housing development. Inside were the new luxuries of gaslight and a kitchen with cold running water. The small garden backed onto open fields. For the first time, the family had its own front door onto the street, although it was unpaved and unlit. Marx grumbled about his exile from his Soho social life, but there were many benefits to this newfound suburban seclusion. He now had his own study. He was absorbed by the development of his emerging prodigy. The baby, he marvelled, is a remarkably witty fellow. Like all of the family and friends, Tussie knew her father as Moor, German for Moor, the nickname he earned on account of his swarthiness and coal black beard. Tussie's first conscious memory was at 3 years old. Moor was carrying me on his shoulders around our small garden at Grafton Terrace and putting convolvulus flowers in my brown hair. Moor was admittedly a splendid horse. 1858 started badly, without coal or cash to pay the rental arrears. Oblivious to these adversities, spirited Tussie played on increasingly sturdy legs in the muck and rubble. Tussie was ringleader of her playmates, trailing her child troop through the house and hosting impromptu tea parties of milk, bread and biscuits provided by the indulgent Lenchen. But Tussie's first friend and primary playmate was Marx. Youngest in the family by a decade and homeschooled by her father, Tussie was as much in the company of grown-ups as her peers. No books, ideas or questions were out of bounds. "The most striking thing about her," her mother wrote to a friend, "is her love for talking and telling stories." When he arrived in England, Marx had a very limited grasp of English. He systematically sought out and classified all Shakespeare's original expressions in longhand and then memorized them. A quick student with a sharp ear and retentive memory, Tussie learnt fast. She recalled that one of her favourite scenes was the soliloquy of Richard III. "I can smile and be a villain, which I know I loved because I had to have a knife in my hand to say it." To brighten Tussie's sixth birthday, her father gave her a special present. Moore always said that bookworming was his favourite occupation. He now passed this gift on. Tussie eagerly unwrapped Peter Simple by Captain Marryat. It was her very first novel. Seized immediately by the adventure, Tussie sailed away from a gloomy North London winter with Midshipman Simple to fight in the Napoleonic Wars. Responding to her enthusiasm for Marryat, Marx introduced his daughter to James Fenimore Cooper. Now Tussie plunged into life under the wigwam. Here were Red Indians, sculping and hand-to-hand combat. This was a mode of existence that seemed very agreeable to Tussie, fiercely resistant as she was to brushing her hair or sitting down to lunch. Not a single day's schooling had yet interfered with Tussie's busy childhood. Her homeschooling with her father was much better than that of her two older sisters, who attended a variety of unlicensed teaching establishment for girls. Whilst Laura and Jenny Chen spent a disproportionate amount of time learning to sing, sew, play the piano and be ladylike, Tussie read widely and deeply, debating everything with one of the greatest minds of the age. At the beginning of 1861, Marx went to visit his mother in the Rhineland to try and raise loans against his inheritance. Henrietta refused to help him. She was unwavering in her complaint that her son would do better to earn money rather than to keep writing about it unprofitably. Whilst Mo was away, Momo ran out of money, and ashamed, she had to ask Engels for help until Marx returned. Marx's work on the first volume of Capital seemed to be progressing well, but even he had to admit that they were sliding too close to penury. Much to Engels' amusement, he received a letter from Marx telling him that he had just applied for a clerical job with an English railway company. Fortunately, Capital avoided the fate of being shunted into the sidings of history, thanks to its author's illegible handwriting. The railway company rejected Marx's submission because they couldn't read his application for the job. On the 30th of November, Henrietta Marx died, bequeathing £600 to her son. The legacy floated the family into a new house, One Modena Villas, in Hampstead. It was a large detached home with the previously unimaginable luxuries of a big garden and conservatory with a park view. Best of all, Tussie now had a room of her own. On the 28th of September, 1864, Marx attended the founding meeting of the International Working Men's Association. This was the beginning of the age of mass production. Proletarians in all industrial countries needed to coordinate their efforts and organise collectively. In Britain, many people from previous socialist-inspired campaigns joined this new attempt to create an international socialist movement. Eleanor's father was their leader. As an organisation, the association became known as Karl Marx's First International. Leaders of the English working class movement were frequent visitors to the Marx's home. Tussie soaked up the atmosphere, conversations and events around her. Throughout 1865, Marx was seriously ill, his health and nerves straining under the pressure of completing the first volume of Capital. What started as a short essay had long ago developed into his life's work. He was working overtime, fueled by passion, tobacco, insomnia, and the rousing encouragement of his family. In December, he announced that the first volume was finished. There was no money, therefore no Christmas, but the completion of that damned book was as fine an advent in their lives as they could wish for. Tussie was almost 10. She and Volume 1 of Capital had spent a decade growing up together. The year had brought another significant development in the form of a fiancé for her sister Laura. Paul Lafargue, a debonair, wild-haired young French medical student, arrived in London to present a report on the French working-class movement. 6 months later, he was Tussie's prospective brother-in-law. Tussie was an instant hit with Lafargue, who declared her a charming child with a sunny disposition. She was equally charmed and allowed Paul to join the elect who contributed to her stamp collection. With the completion of the first part of Capital and the arrival of Lafargue in their lives, 1865 was a good year for the still carefree Tussie. 2 months after her 10th birthday, she played the popular party game Confession with her family. Her game sheet provides a telling self-assessment. Your favourite virtue, truth. Your chief characteristic, curiosity. Your favourite motto, go ahead.
Tracy Ann Overman was reading from Eleanor Marx, A Life by Rachel Holmes. The abridger was Julian Wilkinson and the producer, Elizabeth Allard.
On BBC Radio 6
Music. Music's always gone hand in hand with social change, and sometimes just one song can galvanise an entire movement.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam.
Today from midday, join me, Jolly and Rubinstein, as we take a not-so-serious look at protest music and change the world, man.
Trying to cause a big sensation.
People are not going to take it forever. They are fed up. They don't want to live in fear.
That's the sound that I want.
From classic Dylan to Plan B, Public Enemy to John Lennon.
Revolution Radio.
Today from midday on BBC Radio 6 Music.